Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we welcome investigative comic Lee Camp. We'll talk about the work he does at Redacted Tonight with Lee Camp, as well as his new book on PM Press, Bullet Points and Punchlines. Later in the program, we welcome back to the show co-CEO Greg Aaron of FreePress.net in the midst of the COVID-19 bailout and stimulus package. Aaron writes, journalism needs a stimulus, and here's what it should look like, turning the situation into an opportunity to bolster the free press. Stay with us on today's Project Censored Show for an hour about investigative comedy and a stimulus for journalism. Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table. Then you probably own. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On this segment of today's program, we are honored and delighted to welcome Lee Camp. Lee Camp is an American comedian, writer, activist, and host and co-creator of the hit comedy news show Redacted Tonight with Lee Camp and Redacted Tonight VIP on RT America. Lee has performed thousands of stand-up comedy shows throughout the United States and internationally. His other books include Moment of Clarity and his 2018 stand-up comedy special Not Allowed on American TV. It's received rave reviews. He's also co-host of the weekly podcast Common Censored, which certainly is something that's very familiar to us here on the Project Censored Show. His new book is called Bullet Points and Punchlines, the most important commentary ever written on the epic American tragic comedy. We are again honored to welcome to the program today the great investigative comic Lee Camp.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I like that, investigative comic. I'll start using it.
Well, there you go. So let's start off right there. I'm pretty sure most of the folks in the Project Censored audience know who Lee Camp is. If they don't, they're in for a big, big surprise, and I'm hoping that they'll all run over and subscribe to your channel and pay attention to the important and biting satire and critical work that you do. So the investigative comic title kind of harkens back to the days of George Carlin, Bill Hicks. You've, of course, got your own flair on satire and comedy. Tell our listeners about how you got started, and then we'll dive right into your material.
I always wanted to be a comedian, or at least a comedy writer. I started writing humor columns when I was 12, and for a while I thought I was just going to be a writer because I'd never been on a stage, never performed, wasn't an actor or anything. And then 17, 18, I finally started doing stand-up, and I was immediately addicted, although back then it was not political at all. It was just largely observational, you know, Seinfeld-style stuff. Did you ever notice that the vending machine snacks never actually come out when you pay for them? It was that kind of stuff. Then it grew, you know, luckily watching some of the people you mentioned, George Carlin, Bill Hicks, many others, and realizing that comedy could be something more significant, something deeper, something darker, something that really made people think as opposed to just laugh. I also, in my early 20s, became more of an activist, doing work on that front, out on the streets a little bit more. And I just felt like if I'm going to be performing every day of the week, by that point I'd already moved to New York and was performing constantly. And I just felt like if I'm going to be on a stage every single day, I want to be talking about something a little more than just the vending machines and the Tinder apps. You know, it kept growing. And I now have this show Redacted Tonight, but I've certainly given up the idea that I would ever have a TV show because, as you well know at Project Censored, the type of things that I talk about or you talk about are not generally welcome on your mainstream media, and that's why they are censored. I really didn't think I'd ever end up on television, but ultimately there is a very tiny window of channels that will allow thoughts like these, allow you to go after the corporate state on a regular basis, allow you to criticize the largest ruling forces in our world. So luckily I have found a place to do Redacted Tonight. This is my first book, at least via a publisher, so it's pretty cool.
Indeed it is. And the publisher, PM Press, out of Oakland, California,
Certainly no stranger to us at Project Censored. Congratulations on the publication of your book, Bullet Points and Punchlines, with a foreword of one of your colleagues, also somebody that had been purged by the corporate media. That's the Pulitzer Prize winner, Chris Hedges, who wrote a foreword for your book. Hedges wrote in the beginning here, he says, in the essay Shooting an Elephant, George Orwell wrote, the power for the ruling elites entails one long struggle not to be laughed at. Withering criticism and cogent analysis of their crimes and peculiarities they can stomach. But when the entire ruling class is reduced to ridicule, when the very presence of the elites evokes derisive laughter, the powerful shrink in size before our eyes, stripped of pomp and power, they become clowns. And once they are transformed into clowns, they become ruthless. Well, Lee Camp, you're a great contributor to evoking such derisive laughter, and our leaders certainly have become more ruthless than ever. A lot of the content of your book talks about these things. Let's talk about a few of the stories in the book, Lee Camp, and of course we can bring it up to the present, all the way up to coronavirus, but let's get some of the myriad ways that you've stripped the powerful of all their pomp and circumstance, becoming clowns, starting with a story that we're very familiar with here at Project Censored. The Pentagon seemingly can't account for $21 trillion.
The leaders do get more ruthless and more dastardly because trying to sustain a system as unequal and as fragile as this one, as our American empire, is no easy task. So they end up performing greater and greater frauds, greater and greater crimes to try and continue the process, continue the system. And we're seeing it now with these massive bailouts due to the economic crisis created by coronavirus. Of course, some of those bailouts will go to the American people, but only a tiny percentage, as they give trillions of dollars to some of the largest corporations in the world. But back to the $21 trillion at the Pentagon, I know you guys have covered it, but there's very few. You know, there's a couple of Forbes articles out there, but very few are willing to get into this mess because it is so incredible. It is a number one cannot really comprehend. $1 trillion, you know, if someone's making $40,000 a year, $1 trillion, it would take them 25 million years to make $1 trillion. Meaning, to make $21 trillion, it would take them 525 million years if you're making $40,000 a year. So it's a laughable amount of money, but it is how much the Pentagon just has these unaccounted for adjustments. And the people defending the Pentagon love to say, oh, it's not actually missing, it's just adjustments, it doesn't count. But in fact, we have evidence of actual missing cash, of cash, printed cash going missing. $13 billion, pallets, tons of printed cash was flown to Iraq and disappeared. So it's not just accounting errors, as they like to say. Putting this off as accounting errors, it doesn't make any sense, you know?
A lot of the contents of your book, I think you had the privilege for a while of writing for Truth Dig. I don't want to get into the politics of what's been going on at Truth Dig lately.
Yeah, seriously.
But a lot of the stuff, I followed you in Truth Dig, and I followed your show. And again, if listeners haven't seen Lee Camp's Redacted Tonight on RT America, I strongly recommend you check it out for a daily dose. The Herald says that you're like Jon Stewart, but with sharper teeth. But you have a way of putting this, and you know, humor is a really powerful vehicle. And sometimes, you know, a lot of the very painful and dark and terrifying things, the topics that you explore that often the corporate media don't, they really require a rapier wit, a sense of humor, and a stiff drink in order to get through understanding how badly the American public and the rest of the world are being fleeced by the 0.0001%. And again, you do it like no other. So riffing on the story of the Pentagon and the $1 trillion missing there, you go on, of course, in several other parts of the book to talk about many other key stories of our day, many of which are ignored by corporate media. One of my favorites, as someone that has been a history professor for a long time, one of my day job hats, you talk about four specific times that the American public has been lied into war. And of course, I'd love to also riff on one of my favorite pieces, which was a piece on how to write propaganda for the New York Times. But I see those stories as pretty well linked.
I think the link is that our legacy media and our corporate media as a whole, their biggest job is to manufacture consent, both for war and for unfettered capitalism. But the manufacturing consent for war is one of their most powerful jobs and one of the most important jobs. And you see it with the New York Times front and center. The four times I list, the largest times we've been lied into war, it starts with the Spanish-American War. and then it goes to Vietnam. And learning about the origins of Vietnam, because I was not alive during it, was one of those breathtaking moments where I realized how false our schoolyard history is. It just amazed me that there is Defense Secretary McNamara, a retired older man in a documentary on screen, on camera, saying that the Gulf of Tonkin attack never happened. And you can go watch it on YouTube. And it's just breathtaking to know that we killed God knows how many in Vietnam based on a lie. And of course, that wasn't the only lie, but that was perhaps the biggest lie. And that's not the first or the last time that that happened. The other ones I list in that piece in the book are the Iraq War. Obviously, we all know about WMD. That's one of the few times that the media was so shamed about having done that, about having pushed this lie for so many years to get us into Iraq to kill a million people. They ultimately have come around and admitted that it was, quote unquote, a mistake. Now, it's not really a mistake. It is by design, but at least they've admitted it, whereas often they just move on and never really come back and have that reanalysis of what went down. And then the final one that I include in that chapter is our bombing of Syria and our war in Syria, because as we now know, there were people at the time saying that there wasn't or very thin evidence of a chemical attack by Assad. But then going forward, we now have seen multiple OPCW whistleblowers come out that their actual truthful report saying that there was no evidence of a chemical attack or a sarin attack was ignored and falsified by the OPCW in order to support the American line that Assad had done the one thing that would get America deeply into that war and bombing Syria. So I do see why you say those two are connected, because it is our media's job to manufacture our consent for war and our consent for the endless killing overseas. And the New York Times did their front page of the arts section attack piece on me, which ultimately had to have multiple retractions. They apparently can't even get through an article about a comedian without lying their pants off. And it was within 3-4 months of another attack piece by NPR's Weekend Edition against me, which seems like this is a calculated move. Apparently, too many people were listening to my stuff, and they wanted to make it so that the main quote-unquote legitimate sources had outed me as this horrible villainous liar, and therefore they could put those into Wikipedia articles, because Wikipedia is a whole other issue where they will take everything the New York Times says as gospel, and they will never take something I say as as accurate.
Unfortunately, our experiences are very similar in that regard, sort of a deification of these prime sources in the corporate media. Interestingly, you mentioned the New York Times and NPR, those sources being more on the alleged liberal end of the spectrum. I'd like to remind listeners that you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. We are speaking with Lee Camp, the American comedian, writer, and activist, host and co-creator of the hit comedy news show Redacted Tonight with Lee Camp. We are talking about his new book that's out on PM Press. The book is Bullet Points and Punchlines, the most important commentary ever written on the epic American tragic comedy. After this brief musical break, we're going to come back and continue our conversation with Lee Camp. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with the American comedian, writer, and activist, Lee Camp. He is host and co-creator of the hit comedy news show Redacted Tonight with Lee Camp and Redacted Tonight VIP on RT America. He's performed thousands of stand-up comedy shows throughout the U.S. and internationally. Also, he's got a 2018 stand-up comedy special, Not Allowed on American TV, which I believe is available for free online at his website right now, and Lee Camp will tell us about that momentarily. He's also the co-host of the weekly podcast Common Censored with Eleanor Goldfield, who, of course, has also been on the Project Censored show before about her work in journalism and activism. Lee Camp, before the break, you were talking about how the corporate press, particularly NPR, New York Times, took it upon themselves to discover your work only to misrepresent it, dismiss it, and so forth. And the one piece that you had that was, I thought, really stellar for people who want to learn how propaganda works, you wrote that in the piece on the New York Times specifically. You said that there's a point-by-point way how to write propaganda for the New York Times. And one is prime the readers, so that's pre-propaganda, using things like guilt by association, limit things that don't fit the storyline. For folks that don't realize how this kind of stuff works in the elite media, you should definitely check out Lee Camp's new book, Bullet Points and Punchlines. So, Lee, tell folks your website and about the comedy special.
The comedy special came out at the end of 2018, but it's pretty much all still exactly accurate. Nothing. So I think people will very much find that it's present day in all the content, but it's called Not Allowed on American TV. The easiest way to get that is LeeCampAmerican.com. I created its own URL. So LeeCampAmerican.com. You can watch it for free. And then the book is at LeeCampBook.com.
Okay, Lee Camp, let's jump into something that's more timely. Once again, a lot of these stories, you can go back years and trace them all the way to the present. So they're ever timely. And you just did another segment on your program here, and this is another chapter in the book. Goldman Sachs just admitted curing diseases is bad for business. So here we are in the midst of the coronavirus crisis, Lee Camp. Tell us about that story.
It's very apropos right now. This was 2 years ago. A memo was leaked, an analyst note was leaked from Goldman Sachs. So this is a top Goldman Sachs person. Basically, they write these notes to tell their top investors, some of the richest people in the world, what they should be doing and should not be doing. And it basically comes out and says that although certain kinds of new technology allows for cures, cures do not have a sustainable revenue stream. They like to use these highfalutin terms to talk to their investors, but not a sustainable revenue stream means you don't make enough profit from curing diseases. So it recommends investing in treatments where people will need them over and over again. And of course, then Big Pharma raises the prices of those treatments and the investors get paid and they all are very happy. Basically, it's saying, don't cure diseases. You give people a cure, they take it once and they're done. It's over. You don't keep getting paid. And then they go on in the note to say, plus you have the added detriment of if you cure something, that person doesn't pass it on to others. This is basically a note from Goldman Sachs talking about how they have a profitable partnership with contagious diseases. They and gonorrhea are just besties. I mean, they work together. They sit in a boardroom meeting together. It is just incredible to see them say that. And I don't know the history of coronavirus. I know that various forms have been around since the 1960s, and this is a novel form of it. But who knows whether we would be closer to a cure right now if our money was being put into finding cures rather than just treatment. So, you know, the fact that the largest investment bank in the world is telling the richest people in the world, don't invest in cures, is truly amazing and I think has a serious ramification that we might be dealing with right now.
I think you're right about that, Lee Camp. Can you also remind listeners where they can watch your program online?
The easiest way, I think, for people to find it is just youtube.com/redacted tonight. Or they can get all the stuff I've mentioned at LeeCamp.com.
We're speaking with Lee Camp, someone that I like to call an investigative comic, part journalist, part satirist, all truth teller. We're talking about his new book out on PM Press, Bullet Points and Punchlines. It's fantastic to see you highlighting the significance of people like Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And in fact, you have a piece in the book titled 18 Ways Julian Assange Changed the World. Could you talk to our listeners about why you think Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are so important and so crucial?
I think there's probably not a single individual or at least a single entity as small as WikiLeaks, meaning, you know, what was it, 12 people or something, that has had such a significant impact on the world. I mean, the ripple effects of the information and the truth they reveal continue to just slam around the world in a myriad of ways. And therefore, our empire felt the need to persecute him and torture him and shut him down and shut down WikiLeaks. I mean, it still operates, but at a much lower level because it was incredibly dangerous. It was and somewhat continues to be, transparency of the ruling elite, the way they run things, and how cutthroat and criminal they are. And it wasn't just about America. A lot of people think that WikiLeaks, because of the propaganda, they think WikiLeaks just had it out for America and only revealed things about America. But they've revealed things about countries around the world. They have revealed top secret stories about Russia, about Peru, about Australia, Britain, and it just goes on and on. So they were really trying to create a transparent world of governance, something we should all want. If we want a quote-unquote democracy, then we should want to be informed as voters and know what we're voting on and know who we're voting for. And really, we learned from WikiLeaks, we do not know that. There is so much we are not told. You, of course, have the most famous ones like the Iraq war logs, the Afghanistan war logs, the Afghanistan papers. But then you have lesser known ones like the Bilderberg meeting notes, the Bible, the Scientology, the trade deals, TPP and TIPA. Those trade deals are the largest attempted corporate takeovers ever created. TPP would have covered 40% of the world economy, and yet the American people and the people of all these countries are not involved in it. We're not told about it. We're not shown it. It's top secret. Our Congress couldn't even go in and take pictures or film it or take notes. It's just insane, the level of secrecy. And so they were able to reveal some of the chapters of TPP, which then allowed activists to point to that and say, this is what they're trying to pass in our name and trying to do to us. And that pressure from activists was ultimately enough to force Donald Trump to pull out of it. Now, granted, this does not mean Trump is a good guy. He did it for his own reasons because he thought it would help him get votes, and he knew activists and voters wanted it. But it still had that impact. So the level of impact and just change that WikiLeaks helped create, obviously helping create the Arab Spring, which then rippled into Occupy, which then rippled into the Bernie Sanders movement, with even the terminology, the 99% and inequality. All of that goes back to us learning what was being done around the world.
And that goes back to Assange and WikiLeaks, from the Chelsea Manning video and the collateral murder video, the Stratfor emails that everybody seemingly has forgotten about, and of course the DNC emails. One of my favorites, of course, was Vault 7 that you wrote about as the last of these ways, that talks about how the CIA admits that they can hack elections and make it look like it comes from anywhere in the world. I wonder if that's timely, Lee Camp.
In that Vault 7, we learned the CIA has tools where whenever they hack something, they just leave some Cyrillic code in there or some Farsi code so that others, when they try and see who hacked it, they go, oh, look, there's Cyrillic code. And sure enough, when they're pointing to, you know, Russian hacking, they always say, oh, they left Cyrillic code.
So, Lee Camp, one of the things that people will look to, especially neoliberals or establishment Democrats that like the establishment press as well, they'll look to things like the New York Times and the Washington Post and talk about the stellar reporting that happens there. And one of the things that oft is highlighted is how the Washington Post has been cataloging the lies and false statements of Donald Trump into the thousands. You did a great piece debunking the Washington Post's lies as they debunk Donald Trump's. Can you give people a brief idea what you did in that section?
Donald Trump is lying, and they are accurate to call him on that lie. But then, within their response, they're telling their own lies. So they'll call Donald Trump a liar for saying that the stock market's doing better because of him, and they say, oh, well, really, it's because of Obama. And then I say, well, what both of them are ignoring is that the stock market does well when workers are fully exploited, when we don't have a choice, when we don't have rights, when unions are crushed and are a tiny percentage of the workforce, those type of things is good for stock, because the stock market, it is measuring the parasites that suck off and extract the wealth of our country. So saying the stock market is doing well and therefore society is doing well would be like looking at the leeches on a dying man and saying the leeches look healthy, therefore this guy must be fine. I point out that even in calling Donald Trump on his lies, they are then creating a false reality, a manipulated reality, a false storyline to tell us as they're doing it.
Indeed, and they keep doing it. And so it's something, again, once folks really get a grip on these critical media literacy, understanding the news behind the news, you start to realize the propaganda is thick, it's pervasive. And Lee Camp, you point that out really well, not only on your program, Redacted Tonight, but in your new book from PM Press, Bullet Points and Punchlines, the final chapter of which, Lee Camp, American society would collapse if it weren't for these eight myths. So in this last part of our segment here, why don't you run down a few of these staggering myths of American society?
This goes back to the old quote that the best kind of slave doesn't know they're a slave. So if we believe these certain myths about our society, then we will continue to work our asses off, never questioning things. Some of the myths are that we have a democracy when, in fact, a large Harvard study found that we have one of the worst democracies in the Western world. And a large Princeton study proved that even if our votes were counted and we were electing the people we wanted to, the federal government almost never does something the American people want that does not align with corporate interests. So whenever the American people get something they want, it's because it aligned with what corporations wanted. And so that is not really getting what we want. And so the idea that we have a democracy is a myth. Another one is that police are your best friends and they're there to help you. It's like, sure, there are some anecdotal stories of police helping people, but for the most part, the vast majority of what police do is insert themselves into people's lives in order to keep minority groups down and perpetrate the completely illegal war on drugs, which is a war against our own people. Drug use should be a health issue rather than a crime issue. And we've used it to create the largest prison state in the world. So, yes, there are some times when cops are helpful to people, but most of what they do that is helpful could be done by other jobs that we could create. For example, many people that are arrested are mentally unwell, and we need mental health professionals rather than guys with guns to go deal with that. Another myth that's in there is that you are free. It's like, sure, we have a certain degree of freedom. However, we're not truly free in a lot of ways. If you think you're free, try walking down the street topless, ladies, or in a lot of states, try smoking a joint. Try even walking down the street with an alcoholic beverage. There's a million things we can't do because we're not truly free. We are partially free to do certain things as long as it fits inside the consumerist, materialist world that we are told is the be-all and end-all. And most of these things can be done by corporations. They just can't be done by us. A corporation can pollute all they want and destroy our land. But if you were to go and in a neighbor's yard, then you get arrested. But a corporation could do the factory equivalent to entire thousands of miles and destroy whole rivers, and that's fine. And that also goes to another one of the myths that we have a fair and equal court system, criminal justice system, when in fact it really is ruled by the rich. It is ruled by those with the most expensive lawyers. It sides with the rich and the powerful a large percentage of the time. Those myths are what keep our society going, because if everybody realized the truth, I don't think everybody would go about their days and go to their jobs per usual.
Indeed, Lee Camp. And your latest book by PM Press is Bullet Points and Punchlines, the most important commentary ever written on the epic American tragicomedy. Abby Martin, journalist and host of The Empire Files, says Lee Camp is not just a comedian. He challenges the corporate war narratives and calls out the American empire's, well, something we can't say on the radio, better than anyone, lies we can say, right? His passion and anger are infectious and far too rare. Well said, Abby Martin. Lee Camp, it's been a delight to read your book. It's been a great honor to have you on the Project Censored show. Thank you so much for talking about Project Censored on occasion in the work that you do at Redacted Tonight and, of course, on the Common Censored podcast. Just keep up the great work, Lee Camp.
Thanks for having me. It's quite an honor. I love your work. And it's become a yearly tradition for us to do an episode based on everything from Project Censored. So keep it up.
Yep, thanks so much, Lee Camp. And again, listeners, you can go to leecamp.com to learn a lot more. You're tuned to The Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We've been talking with Lee Camp. Up next on The Project Censored Show, we're going to talk about a stimulus for journalism. We'll welcome co-CEO of Free Press, Craig Aaron. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are going to welcome Craig Aaron. He is co-CEO at freepress.net and also Free Press Action. He's been the head of the organization there since 2011. And for more than 15 years, Craig has been a leader in major campaigns at Free Press to safeguard net neutrality, stop media consolidation, oppose unchecked surveillance, and defend public media and sustain quality journalism. Listeners to the Project Censored Show, of course, are no strangers to the work of Free Press, the very vital work that Craig and his colleagues do. So we welcome back to the program today, Craig Aaron. Craig, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thanks for having me back, Mickey.
Of course, we could have you and your colleagues on every week with updates of the important work that you do, but you recently wrote a piece in the Columbia Journalism Review. It's also online at cjr.org. The article is called Journalism Needs a Stimulus. Here's what it should look like. And of course, this was published March 24, and you have an appropriate coronavirus frame here. But you're asking for a recovery package for journalism. So, Craig Aaron, talk to us about this.
Most of your listeners, they're well aware of the crisis and probably aware that Congress has moved in response to pass a series of bills, recovery and stimulus bills, the latest of which is a package nearing or perhaps surpassing $2 trillion targeted at economic recovery. And as these debates have been moving through Washington, what I wanted to do, because we anticipate there's going to be more bills, within that, I believe we need to start paying attention to the crisis in journalism. And that right now, in this moment, where people are stuck at home, where trillions of dollars are moving out of Congress, where there are serious problems happening at the local level everywhere, where people need the health and safety information to keep themselves safe and healthy, that we need to be looking at who's going to do that, who's going to do the reporting, who's going to be out there on the beat. And in talking to journalism outlets of all shapes and sizes, there's real concern that if there's not some kind of intervention, that they're simply not going to exist anymore, that they're not going to publish anymore, that they're going to have to shut their doors. So what we're calling for is a $5 billion package that would support public media, commercial media, begin to lay the foundation for the kind of longer term changes we need to see, and that we need to move now. We need to start putting money in the hands of journalism outlets to make sure they can keep reporters on the beat, in the seats of the newsroom, and actually tell people locally what's happening.
The main trend, of course, over the last several decades, consolidation of newsrooms, so-called downsizing of newsrooms, the number of active reporters working for the bigger publications or establishment media has been literally sawed in half in the 21st century. Not to get too much into the dearth of local journalism, but how bad have things gotten?
Things have gotten really bad when it comes to local news in particular. I mean, if you look a couple decades ago, there were more than 50,000 working journalists who were showing up every day and doing news gathering. There were a lot more reporters out there going to city council meetings, going to school board meetings, paying attention to what was happening. And those numbers have dropped at least in half. I mean, we've had the halving of newsrooms. And when you start to really get down to the local level, it starts to get really scary at just how few people are out there covering the news, especially in what used to be daily newspapers, now increasingly digital. But even with the emergence of online outlets and new alternatives, just in terms of pure numbers, we're talking about half of what we used to have 20 or 30 years ago. And it's getting worse every year, to the point where it looks like maybe a quarter of the nation's working journalists are employed by the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal in terms of daily journalists out there doing news gathering, writing stories. So that means in the whole rest of the country, at these local papers, that's just what's left. And so you're looking at places like Cleveland, where I think there are 14 unionized reporters left in the newsroom.
Oh,
big parts of the country that used to have 200, 300 journalists working now have 20, 30 journalists working. So we have these gaps. And what happens over time when you have these gaps at the local level is you see really negative impacts locally. I mean, lots of academic studies out there that show when you don't have reporters on the beat, your representatives in Congress don't bring things back to your district. Some of them didn't do a great job of covering elections and campaigns previously, but you used to have a press corps following around anybody running for, say, the Senate. You know, maybe there'd be five or six reporters tailing them. Now, maybe there's one, maybe, but otherwise nobody's paying attention. And as you get to like the real stories of our time, if you're talking about covering inequality, you're talking about covering poverty, you're talking about covering environmental damage, forget it. It's not happening, especially at the local level, in ways that people need. And I think this particular crisis moment, this pandemic moment, really raises that up because, look, I subscribe to the New York Times and I can read about what's happening there, but ultimately I need to know what's happening in my neighborhood. I need to know what's happening in my county. Where do I go to get information? What's safe? Which hospitals are overrun or not? All of this information that we rely on journalists to do is literally life-saving information right now. And that's why I think we really need to bring this into focus and move some immediate support to newsrooms to make sure people can be out there reporting. And then at the same time, we need to be talking about what kind of news system do we actually need to meet those needs? Because look, a lot of these failures have to do with larger economic trends and the rise of the platforms. But we can't ignore that a lot of the industry's worst wounds were self-inflicted, right? A lot of the problems newsrooms have are a result of corporate greed, runaway media consolidation, all these bad decisions. And while I don't want to reward anybody for making those bad decisions, ultimately my concern is, what are we doing for working journalists? What are we doing for the locally owned and controlled outlets that are left? And how do we ensure that people can actually get the news and information they need? Because right now we're living through, honestly, both in terms of public health and in terms of politics, we're living through what happens when those essential checks disappear.
Well, Craig Aaron, that's precisely what we argued in our last book, United States, a Distraction. In fact, the prologue of it, How Did We Get Here? We have the Lao Tzu quote that says, if you do not change direction, you may end up where you're heading. In other words, what you were just saying, what's going on with the state of journalism in the United States today didn't just happen with the outset of COVID-19, didn't just happen during the Trump years or Obama years. We trace this back to the 1960s and 70s, the Lewis Powell memo, the trope of the liberal press, the liberal media, the assault on the press in the Reagan years. This has definitely been the trajectory, the 1996 Telecom Act, prior to that, the dismissal of the Fairness Doctrine. We've been seeing this coming for a long time. It's been like a slow motion train wreck. So in order to get that bigger picture, I think it's important, just because we're not going to be able to push a couple buttons or pull a couple rabbits out of a hat and fix what's been half a century in the making.
We got to start somewhere. And I think that's why you can't miss these opportunities, or I guess crisis-tunities. We have an opening. I mean, 3 weeks ago in this country, the idea that the U.S. Congress, with a Republican-controlled Senate, was going to be passing a $2 trillion stimulus bill, flawed as it may be, the idea that that was happening was impossible. So my hope through this piece and advocacy in Washington on this is to say, we need to respond here too. Here's a huge crisis we can actually help address in this moment, stop some of the worst things from happening, and start building what we actually need. And if we're going to be handing out trillions of dollars, billions of dollars to the airline industry, the auto industry, chambers of commerce, then we need to be paying attention to journalism. And I think in the short term, that really means really focused on how do we keep more journalists at work and on the beat. That's the first phase. But then we have to get serious about finally investing in a public media system that looks more like what you could find in the rest of the world. We need to broaden that definition of public media far beyond PBS and NPR. We need, of course, be talking about community radio like Pacifica. We need to be talking about community media centers. We need to be talking about nonprofit news outlets, encouraging collaboration, encouraging community engagement. The market is not going to provide the news we need to have a democracy that works. We just tried it. It's coming home to roost here, and it's not good enough. That doesn't mean we're not going to have commercial outlets, and my proposal includes billions of dollars to help commercial outlets, and I think that should, again, be targeted broadly. You should emphasize local ownership. But we've got to also build up a non-commercial system, which is frankly going to pay dividends for that commercial system as well, really focused on keeping people informed, creating jobs, doing all the things we need, and recognizing that this system we've got right now isn't giving us what we need. It isn't giving people the information they need. it's spreading misinformation and disinformation, especially through the sort of state media apparatus at Fox News that's been built up around the Trump administration. But, you know, really everywhere, there's real limited information, and we're seeing what happens when that's the case. People continuing to gather where they shouldn't, false health information, all of these things in an emergency. We need to build something better, and this is our opportunity, I think, to start doing that and getting serious about it.
Well, Craig Aaron, I think you're absolutely right about that, and the scholarship behind all of the work that you're talking about, and we're going to get to the crux of your Columbia Journalism Review article here momentarily after a break. But, you know, the work of Bob McChesney was arguing about this decades ago. Victor Picard, of course, his recent book, Democracy Without Journalism, Confronting the Misinformation Society, again, really hits on all of these points. So coming back more positively.
What does our alternative look like? I mean, I think that's the challenge to all of us as activists, whatever your issue is right now. This is a moment to not just accept what the big corporations want, what the Trump folks or the Democratic establishment wants, but to actually reimagine in a moment where we're showing we all need each other, that there can be an alternative. You know, what is disaster democratic socialism? What is disaster humane capitalism? We have to be having those conversations. People are really ready to say, like, show me how this is going to benefit me in my daily life. And they need it right now. And in media and communications, we're right in that focal point. Everybody's stuck at home. They're relying on an internet connection, if they're lucky to have one, to find out news and information. They're desperate for it. We need to meet that challenge in a way that's sustainable and not fall into these same traps that we've done before, where we just hand it over to unaccountable corporations to run roughshod.
The same thing with Medicare. This is exactly why we need some kind of disaster Medicare system. We need disaster educational system to prop up the public education system so that we don't have civically and scientifically illiterate citizenry. But that's also why journalism, I think, is central to all of this. And going back to Nick Johnson, your second priority, whatever your first issue is, if your second priority isn't reforming the media and making it more publicly accountable and central to everything we do, you're likely to gain very little ground in your primary area of interest, the great Nick Johnson. I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We have on the line with us the co-CEO of FreePress.net, Craig Aaron. And after this brief musical break, we're going to come back and talk to Craig about an article that he had recently published for at the Columbia Journalism Review. And we're going to get into some of the prescriptions that Craig calls for. Journalism needs a stimulus, and here's what it should look like. We'll tell you that right after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Craig Aaron has been in the trenches working for media freedom, working for truly free press for nearly a couple decades now. We've been in a lot of the same circles over the years working toward those solutions. And again, one of the things that I've long appreciated about Free Press, the organization, and Free Press Action, is that they really are on the ground looking to build solutions to create a better system of information dissemination. This is an organization where the rubber meets the road, and Craig Aaron has been one of the folks steering that for quite some time. We're delighted to have Craig on right now in an era of great crisis, and at the core of that, too, everyone is looking for information, accurate information about what's happening with coronavirus, what's going on with the stimulus package, who's getting what, and so forth. Not just positives and negatives, black and white, but looking at a macro of our whole system, that this is a great opportunity for us to really rethink public journalism or journalism in the public interest. And Craig Aaron certainly couldn't have many folks on more expert than you about this topic. So, Craig, could you talk to us about what's at the core of this stimulus for journalism and what should it look like? This is the focus of your Columbia Journalism Review piece.
I think basically my proposal breaks down into three main parts with some bells and whistles around the edges. But, I think as a premise, it's important to know that there is fast-moving legislation. Congress just passed a $2 trillion stimulus package. We're being told there could be another two recovery-related bills that move in the next month or two, as they should. You know, the crisis is of a size that we need massive public investment. And my argument is that journalism needs to be a key part of that. So what I've proposed is a $5 billion stimulus package with emphasis on stimulus, which is moving money out and putting it into people's hands as quickly as possible. So the first part of the plan involves public media. And what I've proposed is a doubling of the public media budget to $930 million. This is honestly still a fraction of what we should be spending on public media in this country. But I think instantly moving to put more money into the public media system is the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do for education. We have opportunities to create programming while kids are stuck at home. And there's some emergency needs for stations, especially smaller community stations. Let's make sure those community radio stations and smaller television stations can stay on the air in this crisis, serve local audiences. And then I've made a call that public media also really needs to invest in journalism and news gathering. I think that this certainly exists in some degree, especially on the radio side, but on television is very, very limited. I think we need a stimulus focused on non-commercial media, not just your traditional PBS and NPRs, but as broad a definition as we can create to move funds, to put reporters on the ground, first and foremost, to pay attention to this health crisis and this looming economic crisis. I've also called for a specific set aside to support new and emerging nonprofit newsrooms that are already doing news gathering, doing a lot of government accountability work. I think they deserve some special attention. So that's the first part. We should be thinking in those kind of terms, you know, at that kind of level. $5 billion is half of 1% of a $1 trillion package. And it feels like that's the least we could do for journalism. And so I would start on the non-commercial side, but not stop there.
You mentioned a few ongoing projects in the Columbia Journalism Review project. And of course, one of the things that came to mind, well, two things actually. One, you mentioned radio, specifically community radio. One of the memes floating around social media in the past week has been, if only there was a medium where people could stay up to date on what was happening right in their local areas. Yeah, like radio. It's only been commercial since 1920. There is this thing called radio, and it's a really great resource. Craig Aaron, you know that the right wing really noticed the use of AM radio in the 1990s.
Absolutely.
And I think that ceding those kinds of technologies and bandwidths and so forth to only those interests is a big mistake. They should be in the public interest.
I mean, there are numerous examples. We're actually preparing a complaint to the FCC because so much right-wing AM radio has been trafficking in coronavirus conspiracy theory. People that know better trying to spread misinformation at this crucial moment of real national crisis is incredibly dangerous. And yet, as you say, we've ceded too much of that. Although, in all of this, I take an all of the above strategy. We have to work across the platforms, but we should not neglect something like radio. And especially because if you're a 14-year-old kid, you're not paying a monthly subscription to the New York Times. You're not accessing that content. We need to make the good quality local content available to everybody. Radio is a great way to do that. Everybody can get it. They can get it at home. They can get it in their cars. And of course, we can put it online. We have to think about those kind of things, especially in a crisis moment like this. In a moment like this is when a lot more people's eyes get opened to how alone they've been left in this moment. And this is one reason I say in this small way, relatively small way, we need to prioritize journalism and news gathering because we need to get people this information.
It's not stated that journalism is the lifeblood of democracy for nothing. We really need a robust stimulus in the way we gather information in our free press system. And the Civic Information Consortium is one of those projects that you all had been working on in the last couple of years. And you also have a couple of other projects.
We have a project in New Jersey and North Carolina, one about to launch in Colorado. We're talking to people in Ohio and Pennsylvania, people who, you know, 5-10 years ago never would have thought like public investment in journalism. I don't know about that. are suddenly like, oh my God, it's happened and there's nobody left covering what's happening here. Even if communities are growing or shrinking, right? It's on both sides. So the people in Youngstown are like, how are we supposed to know what's happening here? But so are the people in Denver, supposedly booming community where the population is growing. And yet because the hedge funds and everyone else have hollowed out the Denver Post, shut down the Rocky Mountain News, et cetera, they don't have reliable information. And all of a sudden, a lot of people, frankly, across the political spectrum are saying, we need different kinds of public answers. So we've seen that in New Jersey. We passed a bill there devoting several million dollars in public money to support community information needs. It's a pittance compared to the real need, a couple million dollars. But I think it's a model that says, yes, we need public investment. We need to hand it out at the local level. We need to encourage collaboration between different kinds of outlets. And frankly, we need to support the kinds of projects and people who have never been served by the mainstream corporate press. And the fact is, like, I can look back at the good old days of journalism that we were talking about when there were 50,000 reporters. I want to see 50,000 reporters again, but I want them to look different than those 50,000 reporters, because for most people, the good old days of journalism simply never existed. It did not apply to their community, did not cover their concerns or the issues they were facing. But we have an opportunity to reset that. And I would like to see this stimulus opportunity. We've called for an initial seed investment of $2 billion to create what we're calling a First Amendment Fund, a pool of public money that could be distributed at the local level for innovative journalism and community information projects. That's not enough to solve the problem. You probably need 5 or 10 times that to really talk about replacing what we've lost, but it would be a great start. So I think if you combine that with some short-term stimulus, also directed at the commercial newsrooms. They're equipped to put reporters to work right now, get their content out there. We got to make sure those jobs are kept, and we've proposed stimulus. Anybody who's employing people in a newsroom should get money. We've proposed $25,000 a position, which if you have 25,000 journalists in the country is about $650 million, that we should do that right away. Put that money out there, keep those folks on the job, start to look at longer term supports that can increase the size of newsrooms going forward, but then also start earmarking money, not just to hold up what we used to have, but build new things. Again, this can be bipartisan. This can reach across the aisle when it makes sense. But what we're seeing in community after community after community as we go across the country is people want their stories told. They want to tell their stories themselves too. I mean, anybody like you who's worked in community radio for a long time knows how powerful that can be. We just have to give them the ability to do it. And to be clear, like the ability to be paid. There's still volunteer opportunities, but we need working journalists who can go out there and cover these stories that the rest of us, frankly, don't have time to pay attention to. We don't have time to go through a 1,000-page stimulus bill and figure out what all the boondoggles are. We need journalists trained and paid to go and do that.
Absolutely, Craig Aaron. And that's where I wanted to wrap up the segment. Recently, I've been chairing the journalism program at my college, at Diablo Valley College. Interestingly, it's also in revitalization. That's code for a program that needs a real stimulus. So it's very interesting that this is all happening. And so part of that is rebuilding what that program looks like, because we have to educate not just people that are interested in journalism, but a big part of this program is how do we get everybody to understand that everybody actually needs to be interested in journalism in order for us all to get the information we need to achieve all of the other things we're trying to do in our lives. So what words do you have to say about the significance of really trying to support journalism programs and all of this, and something hopeful that people should have jobs to look for, right, when they get to the other side, that they're not just interning for the nonprofit and they're not just podcasting in their basement?
A big part of this is job creation. And I think one of the things in this moment that we're seeing, whatever industry you're talking about, but it certainly is true for journalism, it is for anything else, is this has to be a conversation intertwined with workers' rights. You know, we need to make sure people are getting paid a living wage and then some. And we have the resources to do it. We've just handed it over to the hedge funds. We need to reset that balance. We need to incentivize hiring at the local level so that we know we're going to have consistent hiring. We need to incentivize ways to get these hedge funds to sell these properties that they've destroyed, frankly, back to local owners and give them enough running room to be able to set things up again. I think those are the kind of things we need to look at. And yes, I think like looking at jobs programs, expanding things like the Report for America program, that these young journalism students can go out into places that are desperate for someone to do local coverage. I love the idea of, as much as possible, getting people from communities being able to cover their own communities. But there are a lot of places where the local media infrastructure has collapsed. And if it hasn't happened already, it could happen in weeks or months because of this economic crisis. So I think this is the time to be investing in journalism education, of course, in media literacy, which is so important to Project Censored and has opened so many people's eyes that the media they have isn't always telling them the truth, and that it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, I think this is the thing, that the media isn't just something that happens to you. It's something that you actually have to organize to shape and change. That's important for students, and that's important for journalists too. Journalists have been told time and again, like, politics isn't for you, stay out of it. And look, if you're the congressional correspondent, fine, don't share your political opinions. But for everybody else, you cannot afford to be objective about your own demise. You have to get in this fight, and that means demanding the kind of policies and resources we need to actually inform communities. And right now we're living through an example of what happens when you don't do that.
Well, Craig Aaron, that was so well put and eloquently stated, and that's the note that we're going to end on for today's segment. You can learn more at freepress.net. Their work is so vital. The name says it all, to our free press. And so we've been talking a little bit about Craig's recent article at the Columbia Journalism Review, which you can read online. Journalism needs a stimulus, and here's what it should look like. Craig Aaron, thanks so much for what you do, and thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule and with what all we're dealing with right now to come on the Project Censored show.
Thanks so much for having me, Mickey. Really appreciate the time and all your work.
You've been listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm the executive producer of the program, founded in 2010 with Peter Phillips and myself. We're on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. My co-host is Chase Palmieri. And we'd like to direct you all to our social media sites online. Of course, the website is projectcensored.org to learn more about our program or hear archives of previous shows. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Project Censored. Feel free to contact us through our website, projectcensored.org. We'd love to hear your feedback. But most of all, we like to thank all of you for tuning in. And we also wish all of you well during these trying times. Guys, democracy, politics, and the apocalyphse got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. Fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We